You are listening to The Book Judge, a podcast about books that give you important insights if you're interested in business. I'm your host, Conrad Chua. This is your curated reading list that'll give you a better grip on how to approach the complex issues that businesses face. I'm recording this in October 2020, which is also Black History Month. I therefore chose a book that looks at the complex history of Black capitalism in America through something that we can all identify with, fast food. Today's episode is the book Franchise, The Golden Arches in Black America by Marcia Chatelain. At a time when consumers, employees, and politicians are all asking businesses to take a stand on diversity and racial equality, this is a timely read on how we got here. Most of the business literature about the history of McDonald's has centered around Ray Kroc, the man who forced out the original founders of McDonald's and created a fast food empire. Ray was a larger-than-life character who was played by one of my favorite actors, Michael Keaton, in the movie The Founder. That movie focused on how Kroc stumbled upon the ideas of franchising to the middle class and also owning the real estate of his franchise restaurants. That combination proved to be the rocket fuel for growth. Kroc stopped at nothing to achieve his vision of global fast food domination, including stopping the founders from ever using the McDonald's name in their restaurants. I mean, that's their own name. The movie is like There Will Be Blood, but with Big Macs instead of oil. Chatelain's book fills in the huge gaps that the movie and businesses cases ignore, and that's the role that Black capitalism and consumers played in the rise of McDonald's in America. Black-owned franchises are consistently some of the most profitable restaurants in McDonald's America operations. And while McDonald's has done a lot in supporting local communities, the overall picture of their impact is more muddied. The McDonald's brothers started their restaurant in California, along one of those new highways that Americans were flocking to in their new cars. In 1954, Ray Kroc joined the brothers and started McDonald's on a path that would see them far outpace the other fast food chains that were emerging at the time. Think Burger King, Wendy's, Taco Bell. McDonald's rapid growth in the 1960s coincided with the rise of the civil rights movement in America. Initially, McDonald's tried to avoid having to confront the evils of racism. Most of its franchises were in California, where there wasn't that segregation that you saw in the South. But McDonald's was forced to look at the issue of how it was going to serve the Black community after the nationwide unrest following the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. Its solution? To ride the wave of Black capitalism. Black capitalism was not a new idea, but in the late 1960s, it managed to attract a wide political coalition. The Nixon administration joined Black leaders in promoting federal loans, economic grants, and affirmative action policies for federal contracts as a way to solve the country's wounds while playing to the economic conservatives. The government saw franchising as a way to revitalize inner-city neighborhoods that had been blighted by urban decay and the riots. So there were many schemes to encourage franchising in inner cities. Moving to the inner cities was not a natural move for McDonald's, but it turned out to be extremely profitable for the company. Most of the fast food companies started in Southern California and appealed to the American middle class with their cars and going on the highways. But McDonald's was different in one aspect. They owned the real estate that their franchise restaurants were built on. So Ray Kroc saw a huge opportunity when inner city sites opened up for restaurants. The property values there were depressed after years of deprivation, white flight, and in some cases, riots. McDonald's franchising model effectively outsourced the higher insurance and maintenance costs of inner city restaurants to franchisees. And when revenue from inner city locations exceeded anyone's expectations, so did McDonald's profits. Opening locations in inner cities made McDonald's recognize that they needed black franchisees. Starting in the 1960s, they recruited a small but growing number of black franchisees who oversaw some of their most profitable locations. What McDonald's did not count on was these black franchisees organizing themselves into the National Black McDonald's Operators Association, or NBMOA. That association continues to exist and has become a powerful voice within McDonald's. This is the part of the podcast where I place the spotlight on one part of the book that you can use immediately in a business or in an interview or just to impress your business school friends. I call this the Did You Know section. We've all seen fast food ads, but Chatelaine does a deep dive into how McDonald's learned to sell burgers to the black community in America. They did this by working with one of the few African advertising executives in the early 1970s. Tom Burrell. Burrell's work with McDonald's helped propel his young agency to become a global advertising icon. At the time, McDonald's had these national advertising campaigns that catered to the white middle class demographic. But these ads became a point of contention with black franchisees who had to contribute a percentage of revenue for these marketing efforts that did not resonate with their predominantly black customer base. Chatelaine brings out one example in her book. There was this campaign called You Deserve a Break, which was a national success that McDonald's wanted to circulate to its black franchisees. Burrell personally studied the reaction of black customers, and he saw that the tagline, You Deserve a Break, was a massive fail with them. Black customers did not have a break in their lives. They were not like white families who could take a break from work and bring their kids to McDonald's as a treat. Black families went to McDonald's because they were hungry and there was little choice in the neighborhoods that they lived in. Burrell retooled the advertising campaign to say, so get up and get away to McDonald's. He also made the print advertisement to feature exclusively African Americans. He wasn't satisfied with replacing white faces with African Americans. He dressed the models in Afrocentric clothes and jewelry. It was a huge success. So bear this in mind if you're launching a new product or service. Think about your assumptions regarding your target market. Sure, you might have the big data behind you, but are there groups that are not captured by your data? Do you have someone on the team who understands these neglected groups? McDonald's continued to build on the success of this first campaign to reach out to black customers. In the 1980s, they controversially introduced black slang into their campaigns. But what they also did was to introduce the idea that a job at McDonald's was a good job that could set inner city kids on a successful career path leading to middle class security. There was a series of commercials centering on a character called Calvin, a black teenager who dresses up in hip streetwear the first time you see him leaving his home. Turns out he's on his way to working behind the counter at McDonald's, where he learns discipline and responsibility. For those of you who are in the Book Judge Facebook group, I'll post the video of these ads there for you. Anyway, the Calvin series runs over several years, and we see Calvin become a member of the management team in the local McDonald's and ends with him working to own his own franchise. Now, I don't know about you, but when I look at these commercials in 2020, I spot these little tropes that reinforce negative perceptions of Black America. For example, there are always these men just hanging around a corner trying to get Calvin to join them, throwing some basketball shots or something like that. They don't seem to be working. Chatelaine points out that there were still very few black franchisees, and presumably almost none of them came through the ranks of flipping burgers. In fact, The end of the Calvin series of commercials coincided with the rise of that idea of McJobs. These were dead-end jobs that paid very little and had no career prospects. I was in college at the time, and I remember the joke that English majors could only look forward to flipping burgers. But these ads did try to show McDonald's grounding themselves in the community. This was a conscious corporate decision that manifests itself in corporate McDonald's allowing local franchisees to choose which local initiatives to support. And one area where local and corporate McDonald's really focused on was sports. They supported everything from the local high school sports teams all the way to sponsoring national youth sports. Whatever you feel about fast food and McDonald's, you have to acknowledge the role that it played in promoting many of these sport community initiatives. I'm from Singapore, and I too remember how McDonald's in Singapore supported the elderly population, whether that was in hiring older people, including my father, I have to say, or having very positive ads about the contributions that the elderly could play in society. In America, all this community work led to the perception that McDonald's restaurants avoided damage and destruction during the 1994 Rodney King riots because they were part of the community. It's not clear that was what really happened, but it was a perception that McDonald's was happy to promote. In 2016, one McDonald's in the city of Ferguson, Missouri, became the focus of America in the wake of the Michael Brown riots. Journalists and police officers used the McDonald's on Florissant Avenue to get drinks or to charge their phones. But there was also looting and destruction at that restaurant. Whatever happened, images of that McDonald's was on every TV in America as media covered the riots. And this brings me to my big takeaway from this book. That when you peel away the corporate PR and political self-congratulations about black capitalism, the truth is, there's still a long way to go to achieve racial equality. In the US, much of the attention this year has been on putting an end to brutal police practices. But all these events happen in a complex web of policies and communities that can't be conveyed in a tweet or a two-minute YouTube video. And this is not just something that's confined to the US. In the UK, where I live now, I belong to an ethnic minority, but in Singapore, where I'm from, I'm part of an ethnic majority that has dominated the leadership of the private sector, politics, and the civil service. In a way, in Singapore, the ethnic Chinese have consoled ourselves that we have this meritocratic system, and that's how the cookie crumbles. But books like Franchise and the underlying data should make people question these assumptions. We need to peel back the data to have a much more open conversation about race and economic opportunity. For every book I introduce, I have this segment called the author question. One question that I could ask the author. Now, Chatelaine talks a lot about food justice in this book. How in every conversation about the poor health outcomes in the black community, it always comes down to their diet, which admittedly does have a higher percentage of fast food and processed food than other communities. But she also pushes back on the assumption that black communities exercise their choice to eat poor quality food. When you look at the entire food infrastructure in predominantly black neighborhoods, there isn't that much choice other than fast food. So my question to Marcia Chatelaine is, what policies can be changed to encourage more healthy food choices to be set up within minority communities? She's not on Twitter, as far as I can tell, but I'll send her the question through her website. That's all for this episode of The Book Judge. You can subscribe to this podcast through Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And that now includes Amazon Music. So if you have an AELXA, you can listen to this podcast with your smart speaker. While you're there, leave a rating. It helps others discover the show. If you have comments, you can tweet me at Conrad Chua 16. Chua is spelled C-H-U-A. Or send me a DM on Instagram. I'm Chua K-H there. That's C-H-U-A-K-H. Till next time, this is your book judge, Conrad Chua.